Language is one of the most important of the social bonds of any community. A language unites. Languages divide. I remember reading some time ago one of the Margaret Mead's many books in which she was describing her long experience working anthropologically with the natives, the Aborigines of New Guinea. And I remember her writing that there were these, some 2 million folk were divided into 750 communities. And that each of these 750 communities spoke a distinct language. And that each of these 750 communities was always at war with all of the others. I read to you this morning from the story of the Tower of Babel. It's placed in the book of Genesis immediately after the great flood. God presumably has destroyed all of humankind except for Noah and his family. And clearly Noah's family unit speaks a single language. And then presumably several generations later after the flood, those who survive and their descendants migrate eastward to the land of Shinar. And there they propose to build a great city whose crowning monument will be a terminal tower reaching up into the heavens. Now this tower is clearly modeled after the great tall ziggurats, the shrine temples which were built by the Babylonians as altars to their gods. And God will not tolerate such a magnificent display of idolatry. And he comes down and he determines to end the work. And he does so by confounding the languages of those who are building. So that each group speaks a separate language and therefore they can no longer cooperate, work together. And he scatters these peoples across the face of the earth. Now this text, coming as it does, placed as it does in Genesis, clearly is an attempt to explain how it is that all the peoples of the earth speak a different language. But it has other meanings. It's a text which clearly intends to speak of the false magnificence of the great shrines of the pagan world. On a deeper level, it suggests to the reader, to the listener, that our work is here on earth. God's work is in heaven. We ought not to concern ourselves about things we cannot do anything about, but do the best that we can here on earth with what we have. But interestingly, the most important text in the story suggests the power of language to unite. If as one people with one language, this is how they begin to act, then nothing that they propose to do will be out of their reach. I confess that I have a soft spot in my heart for those most improbable of all idealists who keep arguing that we ought to develop a single language for our one world. Those who devise an Esperanto or a language of that kind and insist that this is the way to peace. For they're right in one sense. If, in fact, we all could understand one another, many of the misunderstandings which develop so easily between peoples would disappear. Cooperation might replace, to a large degree, competition. But, of course, it's a totally impractical idea, because language is one of the essential ingredients of any person, any community's identity. Deprive us of our language, you deprive us of our roots, of our cultural inheritance, of the folk traditions, of the experiences of our home, all of these things which shape our personality and enrich our mind. But you know, one of the ultimate weaknesses of the modern nation state, perhaps its ultimate undoing, is the fact that a nation state requires a unifying language. And that when the lines were drawn by battle and otherwise to create the modern nation states, These lines were drawn on economic or political lines, bases, but they were not drawn simply to include within the area peoples who spoke a single language. And so whenever a minority or minorities within a community feel that they've been imposed upon politically or economically, one of their instinctive responses is to re-emphasize their distinctiveness, to draw together, to find strength in their background, in their roots, in their traditions. And so they insist that their children be taught the ancestral language, because it is through the language that all of this baggage of identity is brought forward. We've seen this in our northern, to the north, where the French-speaking minority in Quebec and in the eastern provinces felt themselves imposed upon, taken advantage of politically and economically, and they create a great language war, demanding that instruction in their schools be done in French. To find their identity was to find their political base. To find their political base was to demand and to get a fair share of the prosperity of Canada. And it's not so many years ago that in our own United States, as the civil rights movement was beginning to develop and to mature, a black nationalist movement arose, and one of its major demands was that Swahili be taught in the public schools and the black impacted schools. Because somehow, through an African language, the black community would find its roots, find its inheritance, find strength, and ultimately gain political strength. And as we watch in our own decade the emergence of the Hispanic minority in the United States, the issue again is being raised of English as a possible second language of instruction in largely Hispanic schools. Language is a vehicle of identity. It's a means of establishing coherence within a community. It is the means by which we are tied to our past. It is not simply a mechanism for the expression of abstract ideas, a means of communication between people. And this should be clear to us as Jews, because it precisely as an ideological weapon that Hebrew was reborn as a vernacular, as a spoken language in the 20th century. Zionism came into being to take the Jew out of Europe and to take Europe out of the Jew. Zionism came into being because those who were Zionists felt that anti-Semitism was so poisonous, so endemic in the body politic of Europe, that as long as the Jews remained in Europe, their lives would be miserable, they would be politically abused, they would not be granted equal opportunity. It was also important, the Zionists felt, to take Europe out of the Jews. That is, to take the sense of debasement, the fear of what others might say, out from the Jewish psyche, to allow the Jewish psyche, to our emotions, to develop naturally. And that can only be done when we are tied to our own natural and native roots. One of the interesting battles of which the Zionists had during the early days of the resettlement of Palestine had to do with language. Yiddish, the language which was spoken in the homes of most of the pioneers, Yiddish was damned because it was European, because Yiddish was a jargon. Yes, it was written in Hebrew letters. Yes, it included any number of Hebrew words and ideas. But at the same time, it was a bastard language composed of Hebrew and German and Polish and Russian and Hungarian and any number of the other languages of Europe. It had nothing that was integral to the Jewish spirit, nothing which was natural. And more than that, somehow over the years, Yiddish had picked up all of the bitterness, all of the misery, all of the sense of persecution which the Jews were trying to escape. So many of the Zionists felt that Jews in their Jewish national home ought to adopt, because they wanted to create a very modern state, one of the modern languages of high culture. After all, what alternative did we have? There was Yiddish, and Yiddish was out because it was tarred with the galut, with exile, with Europe. And Hebrew to many seemed out because it was simply a synagogue language, a holy language. It lacked entirely a modern technical and scientific vocabulary. It lacked entirely a vocabulary adequate to the needs of the modern world. In 1902, Theodor Herzl published a visionary novel about the Jewish national home called the Upneuland, the old new land. He imagines some decades after the establishment of the Jewish national home a visit by a group of Europeans to this new state. And they discover it to be the very, very model of a modern social democracy. And they discover that the citizens of this old new land are speaking German, the language of high culture, the language of science and technology at the end of the 19th century. And those patrons of the new state, the people in Europe who had somehow made it and were able to send money to establish communities and particularly schools in Palestine, assumed that the schools that they would establish would use one of the modern Western languages as a vehicle of instruction. The Hilfsverein der Deutschen Juden assumed that German would be the language of instruction. The Alliance Israelite Universelle assumed that French would be the language of instruction. The Anglo-Jewish Society assumed, of course, that English would be the language of instruction. But interestingly, among the theoreticians of Zionism, there were not only those who were politically oriented, but men like Ahad Ha'am, who were very much concerned with the spiritual basis, the cultural, the identity basis of this new state. And Ahad Ha'am and his disciples spoke of the need to use Hebrew as the vehicle to give the new Jewish community a sense of its history, a sense of its roots. Had not Hebrew been the language which Jews had spoken when they were early on a sovereign people in their own land, was it not the language of the Bible? And could not Hebrew, in fact, be enlarged, developed, so that it, like English or French or German, could come to use technical terms? Because medieval German and medieval French and medieval Latin and medieval English had, of course, not had the scientific terms. And so Hebrew was there were those in 1890, 1900, 1910 in the Yeshuv who bound themselves to speak only Hebrew in their homes or in their small communities. And what did they do? They simply appropriated any number of words from the European languages. Radio, telephone, universita. And sometimes they went back into the tradition to find a word. There was, of course, no word in Hebrew for electricity. But there was a great vision in the book of Ezekiel, a vision in which Ezekiel the prophet sees a cloud which seems to shimmer with light, and the light seems to come from a single source within the cloud, a great amber stone cut like a jewel, which is light is playing on and shimmering off, the rays are going off in all directions. And in Hebrew, the name of this amber stone is Chashmal, and Chashmal became the term for electricity in modern Hebrew. And so whether they mined the past or they borrowed from other languages, Hebrew quickly developed the necessary technical modern idiom and language. But these European patrons of Israel were pressing, and the issue came to a head around 1913, when the German supporters of a new technical high school, a technicum which was to be built in Haifa, agreed to put up the money if it was agreed that all instruction would be in German. The money was fortunately sent, but then the men who were and women who were to be the teachers of the school struck. They would not be bound by these instructions. They insisted that the language of instruction be Hebrew. And a very nasty incident was avoided only because of the intrusion of the First World War. The German philanthropists were suddenly cut off from contact with Palestine, and they had other things to be concerned with, which is incidentally one of the few good things that the First World War accomplished. In any case, by the end of the First World War and in the years in which the mandate was being established, Hebrew rooted itself in this community. And by 1923, when the new administrative rules of the mandate were established, the British government decreed that along with Arabic and English, Hebrew would be the third accepted tongue for government and administrative purposes. Now, one of the fascinating things about history is that you come to recognize that history is never quite what it seems. that history is full of paradox and anomaly, and there is none perhaps more interesting, and certainly none more appropriate to this morning, than the fact that though the early Zionists assumed that Hebrew was the original and natural language of the Jewish people, in point of fact, this is not so. Hebrew is one of a whole congeries of dialects and vernaculars of languages which developed in the ancient Middle East and West Asia, which are called by the linguists Akkadian, which are called by non-linguists Semitic. Akkadian comes from the name of a town, Akkad. Akkad was one of the original third millennium city-states, which began to develop where the Tigris and Euphrates rivers come together as they begin to flow into the Persian Gulf. And some of the original tablets, and the earliest tablets, which present to us one of these languages that is common to the family of languages of West Asia, was discovered at Akkad. Now, just as the Romance languages include a whole variety of tongues and of dialects, Latin, Catalan, Castilian, Spanish, Old French, Middle French, Modern French, so the languages that are Akkadian in origin include a whole variety of different vernaculars and different dialects. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, the patriarchs of our people, spoke a Western Semitic dialect, a Northwestern Semitic dialect, rather simple dialect, probably one which was tailored to the simple needs of a semi-nomadic people. Hebrew, it turns out, Hebrew was the native language not of the patriarchs, but of those who were the indigenous population of Palestine, the people we call the Canaanites. Indeed, the Bible refers to Hebrew never by the term Hebrew, it's a post-biblical term, but always as Lashon HaKna'ani, the tongue, the language of the Canaanites. Apparently, around the time that Moses led the children of Israel out of Egypt and the people begin to infiltrate, the tribes begin to infiltrate into the Holy Land, about that time they take over the language of the Canaanites, a sister language, probably not that dissimilar from the original tongue, but one which was obviously much more highly developed because the Canaanites had developed a city-state. They were modern for the time, a modern urban society. The Hebrews were a semi-nomadic shepherd society whose language was not as rich, as elegant, as elaborate as that of the Canaanites. Now, our people have always been willing to absorb other languages. That's one of the constants of Jewish history, as I'll try to show in the weeks that lie ahead. We absorbed Hebrew from the Canaanites. We later absorbed Aramaic from the world of which we were a part, Greek from the Hellenistic world, Arabic from the Islamic world, and almost all of the dialects of later life in the countries of which we were a part. But in the process, we came to absorb the Canaanite tongue at a very interesting and important time in the history of the development of language. As you know, the original writing was pictograph, a series of symbols which imaged the object being described. And obviously, when you're dealing with hieroglyphs or pictographs, you have an infinite number of signs which you have to be able to use in order to express yourself, if you're writing on clay or on papyrus or on parchment. And during the second millennium before the Common Era, that is from about the year 2000 to about the year 1200, the scribes of the ancient Middle East were trying to devise ways to reduce this infinite number of signs to a more manageable number. And they discovered what the linguists call phonemes. Phonemes are words, sounds that come together, ma, mi, bo. And they used a single sign for each of these phonemes, thereby reducing the tens of thousands of pictographs to maybe a few thousand phonemes. And then they began to work to try and reduce these even further so that language might be easily set down. And about the year 1250, 1300, about the time Moses leads the tribes out of Israel, scribes in West Asia, Canaanite scribes, discovered the modern alphabet. And interestingly, the word alphabet itself reveals the place of its origin. We took over the Canaanite language. ABC is with us, Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Alpha, Beta, Alphabet. And the Canaanites had cousins who lived along the seacoast, the Phoenicians. And the Phoenicians took this language, this new discovery, and immediately made it known to the Greeks. And the Greeks took over the alphabet, Alpha, Beta, Gamma, Delta. And it became the basis of Greek, and then of Latin, and then of our almost all of our Western languages. The alphabet represents one of the remarkable inventions of human civilization, because it allowed people to write, to communicate, using only 22 signs. Now, one of the interesting things is that the West Asians, the Canaanites, developed an alphabet, a people equally civilized. The Chinese never did. Why? Because of the very nature of the Akkadian, of the Semitic languages. They're based entirely on consonantal roots. Take the word, the consonants B and T in English. Depending on the vowels that I use, I can make almost an infinite number of words with different meanings. Bit, bat, but, boat, beat, about, I could go on endlessly. Akkadian and all of its derivatives create their nouns and their verbs out of single blocks of three letters, three consonants, which never change, and they always come in the same order. Take K and D and S. It makes the word Kadosh. And out of Kadosh, you get Kaddish, Kiddush. You get the word we used in our service today, Kadosh, 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 holy, holy, holy. You get the noun Mikdash for a shrine. You get the noun Kiddushin for a marriage. You get the Hekdesh, material which is devoted to the shrine and therefore which is taboo. An infinite number of nouns and verbs come into being, and the three center terms, the terms that give it meaning, the three consonants, never change. Now, what does this mean? This means that when one writes an alphabet and writes these three letters together, one can guess the essential meaning of the term. A great deal of guesswork went into early writing. They didn't have the vowels that we have today. They didn't have the syllabaries that we have, the dictionaries that we have. They wrote on materials which made writing necessarily limited in scope. But if you could get the basic sense of a sentence, you had really communicated with somebody else. And so every time you saw K and D and S, these three consonants together, you knew that the term had something to do with sanctification, with holiness, with shrines, with things which have to do with the sacred. And so it is with almost all other roots. Now, discovering this, Hebrew was able to do what the Chinese language was never able to do, what the Indo-European languages cannot do, and that is to create a 22-symbol alphabet which is entirely consonantal, which has only consonants and no vowels. Hebrew vowels would come much later and give much more flexibility to the language. But now we have a language which interestingly has certain characteristics. And these characteristics would determine the nature of the biblical material, the nature of Hebrew thought. Because everything goes back to single three-letter roots. Hebrew never is very far from the image, the object, which is basic to the word which is being used. The image in Hebrew is always very pronounced and very clear. Hebrew deals with images. Hebrew deals with that which is very specific. And because Hebrew deals with words that can be used in a variety of ways, the noun and the verb are created out of the same three letters. It's wonderful for alliteration. And because as you decline or conjugate these three-letter roots, the endings and the beginnings that you use are always the same. Hebrew has a certain rhythm to it. It has a certain shape to it, which gives it a poetic, a cadence, a poetic sound, a rhythmic nature as you speak. And so Hebrew is wonderful for poetry, natural to poetry. Hebrew is wonderful for narrative. It can tell a great deal in a very brief space. And Hebrew is not so good for analytic thought, for philosophic thought, for conceptual thinking. An example. If I want to talk of the end of things, of ultimate matters, of apocalyptic issues, of eschatology, I begin to use big words. Hebrew doesn't have these big words, at least biblical Hebrew didn't. So I'd use eschatology if I'm a good Greek who wants to speak of matters dealing with the ends of things, the eschaton. And I say in Hebrew simply, acharit hayamim, the end of days. Specific, clear, simple. Brevity, specificity, these are natural to Hebrew. Take the opening phrase of the 23rd Psalm. Adonai roi lo echsar, four words. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. We require nine words, more than twice as many words in English for the same thought. Brevity, specificity, alliteration, usefulness as narrative, usefulness in poetry. These are the specific characteristics of Hebrew. And they, to a large degree, they shape the nature of the biblical tradition. The Bible isn't a book of philosophy. The Bible doesn't labor with the hard jargon of a professional thinker. It makes its point through illustration. It makes its point through proverb. It makes its point through poetry, rather than through the kind of logic which the Greeks centuries later would make so central to their thought. Language then, Hebrew, went a great way towards shaping the way in which our people express themselves, and went a great deal to the way in which we became significant and limited us in other ways. We are the great poets of the ancient world, the Book of Psalms. The Bible contains some of the great narratives of the ancient world. But you'll not find in the Bible the great books of philosophy of the ancient world, nor the great books of theology of the ancient world. We pray to God, but you won't find a great deal of thinking about, of conceptualizing about the nature of God in the biblical tradition. And one of the interesting facts about Hebrew and the language and the alphabet is that since we came to an alphabet at the time when the alphabet was just being developed, we come to our own alphabet out of an interesting limitation. The Canaanites developed the alpha, beta, gamma, delta, aleph, bet, gimel, dalet, but they never developed a system of numerals. What they did was to use the alphabet as their numerals. Aleph is 1, bet is 2, gimel is 3, and so on. Now, what does that mean? That means that unlike English, every word in Hebrew is also a sum. And every sentence is also a mathematical equation. Now, if you assume, as the pious of our people have always done, that the Bible is in fact the word of God, and that God's words operate on many levels of meaning and many dimensions of thought, you come to the fact that the Bible is not only words which can be understood literally or figuratively or metaphorically, but the Bible is also a series of numbers. And if you can find, obviously, the right phrase in which God predicts, of prophecy, which promises redemption and salvation, and you sum up the numbers from it, you ought to be able to find, implanted in there by God for the benefit of mankind, the date on which the Messiah will come. And if you take the numbers of the 6 days of creation, and you add these up, and you deal with them in certain Kabbalistic ways, and that's what I'm describing to you, then you ought to be able to discover the basic mathematical equations, the architectonics of the universe. And so for our people, over the long years of piety, the Bible has been not only what it seems to say on the surface, not only a book of narrative, a book of poetry, a book of morality, a book of prophetic speech, but it has been a text in physics, a text in messianic speculation. And again, our people have turned to the Bible and found in it the promise in the year 1648, the promise in the year 1320, the promise in the year 1948, the Messiah will come, independence will come to our community, or something of that sort. And this interchange between the alphabet and the numbering system, which exists, as you will know, also in Greek and exists also in Latin, has led to the development of that pseudoscience, which is called Kabbalah, which incredibly has gotten a certain renaissance of interest in this, the most scientific of all centuries and mankind has ever known. And one of the interesting things about Hebrew is that it was spoken for a relatively short period in the history of our people. Hebrew was picked up from the Canaanites in the 12th or 11th century. It was spoken by the Israelites, probably down to the Babylonian exile, probably not much further. And at that point in time, our people began to speak the common vernacular of West Asia, which was Aramaic, a sister language. I'll talk about it next week. But by the time of the Second Commonwealth, that is from the turn from the Babylonian exile in the 5th century before the Common Era down to the destruction of the temple in this year 70 of this era, our people spoke other languages, first Aramaic and then Greek, and Hebrew became more and more the Latin of our world. That is the holy language, the reserved language, the language which was spoken around the shrine, which was used in liturgy, the language which was associated with the sacred. And the less a language is understood, the more it becomes reserved to the temple or to the synagogue, the more one associates with this language the mystery and the power and the aura of the divine, the holiness of God. And Hebrew became associated with all of that charisma which any religious people associates with things divine. So much so that when the rabbis in the first and second century wanted to make clear that what they called the oral law, the other traditions of Judaism which had not been included in the written text, were in fact of God, they insisted that these be written out in Hebrew. And they created or recreated a Hebrew, which you call Mishnaic Hebrew, the Hebrew of the Mishnah, in order to make this possible. And Hebrew was used as the basic language of Jewish worship because it had that sense of mystery and of awe associated with it. We are not the first generation of Jews who do not understand the Hebrew of the prayer book. We are not the first generation of Jews who do not understand the Torah when it is read out and chanted to us. Already in the second century before the Common Era, the Jews had to have what they called a Targum, an Aramaic translation of the Torah read out to them. Now, Jews always mastered the alphabet. They could read the sounds, but very few Jews over these long centuries controlled and mastered Hebrew. Hebrew was called Lashon Chachamim, the language of the sages, the language of the scholars. And modern Jews shouldn't feel at all abashed that they're in a long tradition of Jewish ignorance, because in point of fact, we survived those long years of ignorance. But we survived it in part because of all the associations which Hebrew acquired to itself as somehow being the language of God, the language of holiness. You'll find all kinds of legends in the Midrash that God spoke Hebrew when he called the world into being. That God called out to Adam and Eve in Hebrew in the Garden of Eden. So Hebrew is in fact the native language, the natural language of mankind. And this, by the way, was a belief that was shared by Christian as well as Jew. One of the interesting little sidelights of history. In the 15th century, a Scottish king by the name of James IV set out to prove that Hebrew was the original language. So what did he do? He took two babies from their mother's breast and put them in a deserted island in one of the fjords of Scotland, and he put with them a deaf and dumb nursemaid to see that they were cared for. And he was convinced that as they grew up, they would naturally speak Hebrew to one another. No report is made of the success of this experiment. But Hebrew acquired all of these associations of sanctity and of holiness. And I suspect if there's any concern that one must have about Hebrew today, now that it has been revived as a natural language, is that once you can order a chocolate milkshake in Hebrew, or play the Tel Aviv stock market in Hebrew, or follow a commentator who is describing a brawl during a soccer game in a Haifa stadium in Hebrew, Hebrew loses for you that sense of majesty, precisely that sense of mystery, of awe, of divinity, which has given it its power over the centuries. And when people speak to me of the revival of Judaism in Israel, revival among those who are not, you know, sunk into medievalism, I wonder sometimes as to whether, in fact, that revival can bring with it the associations of kavod, of holiness, of kedusha, which Hebrew has carried with it over the ages. Because once Hebrew has become the language in which you ball out your youngster, the language in which you try to put together the kit that comes from the store with some kind of household contraption, Hebrew no longer can have for you all of these other resonances which it picked up over the ages and which made it such a vehicle for the communication of the sense of awe which lies at the basis of the religious spirit of our people. In America, in a sense, our ignorance protects us because Hebrew still is for us a language which we associate with the synagogue and with that which is holy. In Israel, to those who speak Hebrew as natives, Hebrew no longer has those connotations. For the future, then, Hebrew will continue to be the language of the Jewish national home. It will develop idiomatically in ways which we cannot now predict. But at the same time, I suspect that Hebrew will increasingly lose that sense of awe, which was so important for us over the centuries, and that we're going to have to find, if we care about worship, other ways in which to express reverentially all that we feel about God and about worship. Amen.